From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, we'll talk with one of America's top trade officials in talks with China, Russia, Japan, and other Pacific Rim countries. Also, how a formerly homeless woman in Sacramento used soccer to help get her life back on track. And musician and humorist Neil Innes, you might know him from his work with Monty Python and the Beatles parody group The Ruttles. But first, when Sacramento's arena plan came out last month, we learned where the proposed building would likely be, what it would look like, and how much it would cost, but not where the money would come from. And it's a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars. The team working on the arena plan, along with local elected officials and business leaders, are now trying to figure out how to raise that money. But what sources are they considering? Joining us is developer David Taylor, who's working with the company Icon on this planned new arena. David, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Why was the source of the money to build the arena not part of this report?
Well, we did do quite a bit of analysis in that direction, and as we fully engaged the Maloofs, which was just a couple of weeks before the time that we were going to report the findings, it became clear that both the Kings and the NBA and frankly some of the regional political players felt more comfortable if we would vet that information through the regional body that the mayor is putting together now before going public, because once a preferred method of financing is public, it becomes kind of fair for or fodder for everyone to take shots at, and we felt like it would be better to wait until the regional people weighed in.
You mentioned the Maloofs there, the people who own the Sacramento Kings and Power Balance Pavilion, and they had really been sort of at a remove because they were talking with Anaheim about possibly moving the Kings down to Southern California, so you only really started talking with them quite recently.
Yeah.
But does that mean, though, that if they had been on board earlier and had been sharing their financial information earlier, that the source of money to build a new arena would have been in your report?
Yes.
I see. So what about the political considerations that you alluded to there about bringing elected officials on board, I guess, to help promote any public funding to the public at large?
Yeah, it's not just to promote, but first of all, to agree that a particular strategy makes the most sense, both economically and politically. And then once that is reached, to help sell that to the various community members.
My guest is David Taylor. We're talking about the proposed new arena for Sacramento. How much would this arena cost, the one that you and Icon are talking about for the rail yards?
Our cost that we have on it currently is $387 million. That's a fairly conservative number. We had it fully designed. We had it designed by Populous, a large sports-oriented design firm out of Kansas City, and then the cost estimated by Turner Construction, which is a very large contractor in the country that does a lot of sports facilities. And then we put quite a lot of contingency on it to make sure that we, if the number changes in the future, that it goes down and not up.
Because most people who've been involved with any aspect of construction, whether it's remodeling a kitchen all the way up to building a big building, knows that costs usually rise. But you're saying this $387 million includes any likely increase in cost.
Yes. First of all, Turner Construction put an actual construction dollar amount on it that reflects construction costs beginning in January of 2013, when we expect to start construction, and then on top of that, significant contingency for both design and construction and soft cost.
There was also talk about building an arena in the rail yards in 2006, and at that time, the proposed arena would have cost about $200 million more than what you're talking about. How could an arena today be so much cheaper than one that was talked about just a few years ago?
Yeah, it's a combination of two things. First of all, we, in bringing Icon into the picture here, our partner on this analysis, they have a lot of specific expertise in actually building and delivering these kind of facilities around the world. And so they came in and said, look, we think Sacramento, given its size of its market, needs to be an arena that is about 675,000 square feet, maybe as much as 700,000 square feet. The arena that we were talking about in 2006 was well over 800,000 square feet. So that square footage difference makes up a huge portion of that cost differential. And then, secondly, the actual construction market from 2006 to now has significantly decreased the cost of buying materials and labor. So that's helping out as well.
But if the economy picks up in the next few years, and even with the most optimistic time frame, this would only construction would only start in a couple of years, I think,
yes.
Costs could rise again, could they not?
They could, and that's why we had Turner put a estimate that it reflects projected increases in the market between now and 2013, and then again on top of that a 10% contingency.
One of the criticisms of Power Balance Pavilion, which most people still think of as ARCO Arena, is that it was built on the cheap for the time, the late 80s.
Yes.
Is there a risk that by scaling down this arena plan that Sacramento might end up with another arena that in 10 years' time is too small and out of date?
I don't think so. Let me first say that ARCO Arena, when it was built in 88, was already obsolete. It was, it was built on the cheap even for its time. And what that translated into was an arena that was only 450,000 square feet. And again, we're talking about a 675,000 to 700,000 square foot arena now. And it compares to arenas, the largest arenas in the market across the country now for NBA teams is about 800,000 to 850,000 square feet, and that's Orlando and Staples.
When you started talking actively with the Maloofs, did you and your partners get any shocks for the better or for the worse when you looked at their books?
Well, we haven't looked directly at their books. What we've looked at is the performance of ticket sales and food and beverage sales and suite sales, but we haven't looked at all of their company financials and don't intend to. But I think the most surprising thing right now is that they're fully engaged with us for the first time in quite some time and are really pretty excited about the opportunity now that they've seen the work that we've done, the location, the design, and the quality of the design, and the solidness of the numbers. So I'm personally encouraged by the way they've re-engaged.
What's your gut feeling about public funding of one kind or another? How much public funding do you think would be needed to build an arena? And it's my understanding that you've been saying all along that some kind of public support will be needed. What percentage of the arena cost would come from the public in one way or another? And what kind of sources would you see?
Well, as far as the percentages, that's one of the sensitivities that we have right now that we're not comfortable going public with. But yes, I think the public sources will have to be a significant portion of this financing plan. But in my view, something that's very encouraging that's occurring now when it has not occurred in the past is because the Kings have said that they are, for the first time, willing to be an occupant and tenant only rather than an operator of the facility. It allows us to go out and seek and find and bring in a private national and international sports and entertainment operator who will bring additional private capital to the table that hasn't been offered in the past. And so there'll be a combination of private capital coming from this group of international and national operators, plus the private money from the Kings to help confirm for the public that there's a significant private investment into this deal. We're not looking strictly at the public to fund this thing.
The site that is favored is basically the same site as the long proposed transit center for downtown Sacramento. How did that happen?
Well, our study, our goal was to test fit that site because the city already controls that site. And and also test fit the Natomas site, which is a site that's owned by a combination of the city and the Maloof family. The reason we chose to do that was to focus on sites that were the easiest to deliver, because we do have a tight time frame that we're trying to work to. That does not mean that we won't look and the city won't look at other sites over the next 100 days or so as they do their technical analysis. Yes, I think that is the preferred site by many people, including the mayor. But there is a challenge in trying to fit all of the uses of the arena and the intermodal all on the city-owned site. So we have opened conversations with Inland Realty, which owns all of the rail yard land now. And they've indicated a willingness that if we need additional land adjacent to that city-owned site, that they would be prepared to contribute some land into the transaction.
Is the current site in Natomas just on the table for comparison purposes, or is it actually still seriously being considered?
We were asked to include that in for comparison purposes by the city council, because there was a concern that the cost of providing a new facility downtown was going to be significantly more expensive than doing it in Natomas. And so in looking at that, we compared the cost. What we found was that the cost differential is really quite minimal, only about $3 million between the two locations. And so from the standpoint of the city council action or their direction given to us last week, it seems pretty clear that a majority on the council would prefer to see the site downtown, or a site downtown, as opposed to Natomas.
And finally, David Taylor, when can we expect a financing plan to be made public?
Definitely within this 100-day period, I'm hopeful that it will be, you know, in the early part of that 100 days and not the latter part, but unfortunately, I can't control all of that.
The latter part would be, I guess, the end of August.
Right.
Yes. Developer David Taylor, working with the company Icon on a planned new arena for Sacramento. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, we'll hear how the U.S. deals with all the economic challenges posed by Asia. It's Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On Talk of the Nation Science Friday today, what a war fought over the internet would be like, plus building a map of the local universe. Sci-Fry starts at 11 right after Insight. One of America's top trade officials was in Sacramento this week talking about America's challenges and opportunities in the Pacific Rim. Ambassador Kurt Tong is U.S. Senior Official for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC. Other APEC members include China, Russia, and Japan. I asked Ambassador Tong, what's the biggest challenge the U.S. faces in its economic relations with China?
Well, we've got, as I believe people generally know, a rather large trade deficit with China, and we're trying very hard to expand our exports to the Chinese market in the interest of creating more jobs in the United States and helping energize our economic recovery here.
And what's the reason for that trade deficit?
There are a number of reasons. It's a very complicated picture. There are problems with the currency and currency misalignment. There are issues related to barriers in the Chinese market for U.S. firms, protection of intellectual property, concerns about competing with state-owned businesses, and really difficulties working with the Chinese market in terms of regulation at the state and local level there. So it's a complex picture, a lot of issues to be addressed, but we're working on it as hard as we can.
That sounds like an almost formidable array of challenges to deal with. Which one would you say you're furthest towards resolving, if any?
Well, I think we've made a lot of progress with China on the whole question of transparency in regulatory processes, and trying to work with China, but also with other partners in the Asia Pacific region, to emphasize the importance of a fair rules based system. But it is a difficult process and a long one. Now APEC, of course, is an organization of 21 economies, and we're not exclusively focused on issues related to China, although China is a very important member of APEC. And in the APEC context, we're working very hard on some of these issues, with a focus on creating opportunities for small and medium enterprises, in particular, to get into foreign markets.
Yes,
and with a special emphasis on regulatory processes.
Well, as you mentioned, there are 21 economies in APEC, including the United States and China, also Russia. What do you say to people who argue that the United States should use economic issues and trade issues as leverage with countries like China and Russia when the U.S. disagrees with those countries' human rights records? In other words, should trade issues be used as a bargaining chip to improve the way citizens are treated in other countries?
For the most part, we try and keep trade and economic issues in their own track. The emphasis, of course, is on because trade, when it's done right and done fairly, it's a benefit to both sides, and it is a two-way street. So there's give and take back and forth, and so we're really trying to emphasize to partners in countries like China and Russia the opportunities for them as well. The economies all grow together. And that can happen as long as economies are fairly managed and opportunities are fairly created across borders.
When I look at the list of countries that are part of APEC, it seems to be almost a microcosm of the world. You've got gigantic economies, you've got tiny countries, you've got democracies, you've got authoritarian countries, you've got advanced economies, you've got developing economies. Realistically, what can this group of countries do that they have in common with each other that they can make progress on?
By focusing in on the details of how trade and investment is done between the economies, we can really make progress even with a very diverse group. And there's some advantages to having a diverse group, because in that kind of situation, you get a diverse set of problems that come to the surface. And so while it might be easier for the United States to have an economic dialogue with a like-minded country of a similar economic development level, by having a lot of economies of different levels in the room, a lot of issues come to the fore, and then you can address those directly in the discussion. To give you a specific example,
yeah, please.
We're negotiating now a free trade agreement, which largely came out of the APEC discussion, and there are nine APEC economies that are participating in something called Trans-Pacific Partnership Negotiation. And it's a very ambitious free trade agreement discussion, raising a lot of very difficult issues, but it's also a diverse set of economies. So we have economies like Vietnam and Chile and Peru and Australia and New Zealand, all quite different and geographically dispersed, but united around the idea of trying to eliminate barriers to trade and investment.
My guest is Ambassador Kurt Tong. He's U.S. Senior Official for Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC. He works at the U.S. Department of State. Now, I read an article in The Economist from a few years ago about APEC, and it quoted Gareth Evans, a former Australian foreign minister, who called APEC, Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation, quote, four adjectives in search of a noun. And that was by way of saying that, of criticizing the very need for the group. How would you respond to that?
There's a lot of quotes like that, and some people say it's in search of a verb. Some people, the issue at stake is a question of will. And if the economies come to the table with the intention of doing something and accomplishing something, then they can. And in 2011, under U.S. leadership, we are working very hard to leverage this opportunity and make APEC into a action-oriented forum. Our slogan for the year is quite simple: rather than some long, lofty statement about the Pacific and this and that and the other. It's just three words: get stuff done. And we've laid out a raft of specific achievements that we hope to achieve in 2011, and are working with the other economies to try and reach agreement on those. So we really hope that by the end of this year, people will rather than referring to APEC as a group of adjectives, consider it a really kind of a verb type organization.
What's top of the list of hoped for achievements for this year?
One of the big ones is in the area of environmental goods and services. A lot of economies have given at least lip service to the idea that green trade or trade that helps spread the technology that makes all of our economies more environmentally sustainable and more energy efficient, that trade should be prioritized and liberalized at a faster pace than others because of the great benefits that come from having those technologies shared at the lowest possible cost. And so we're asking the economies to essentially put their money where their mouth is this year and reach an understanding on not eliminating but lowering tariffs in the environmental goods and services area, and also eliminating non-tariff measures that make it difficult to sell environmental goods and services across borders.
I noticed that among the 21 member economies of APEC, you have China and you have Taiwan, which have a contentious relationship, and China doesn't really officially recognize Taiwan. How does that work with them both being members of the same international group?
Taiwan participates in APEC under the title of Chinese Taipei, and it works quite well. We refer to the members of APEC as economies rather than countries, and on that basis, Taiwan is a member of the World Trade Organization. On that basis, all of the parties stand ready to cooperate, and we've actually seen very, very encouraging and positive examples of direct collaboration between China and Chinese Taipei within APEC, doing some joint projects together. And communicating on their shared objective of economic integration.
Well, usually you'd call the members of a group like this countries, but in this case, as you said, they're called member economies. Is it because of the China-Taiwan issue?
That's probably the most important reason, but it also emphasizes the mission of APEC, which is to bring economies closer together and thereby create more economic opportunity. So it's not an international forum in the traditional sense. Really, it's a mission oriented organization trying to reach beyond and really make governments in some ways less relevant by bringing the economies closer together. The another thing that's useful to point out in that regard is that we have very active participation from the private sector in APEC discussions, and unlike most international groups, the participation from private sector and from people outside government is very much encouraged in the APEC process.
The United States has many big friends and big rivals as fellow members of APEC, but there are some other lower-profile countries there, like Papua New Guinea. What issues, for better or for worse, does the United States have with Papua New Guinea, if any?
Our main interest with Papua New Guinea is to encourage economic development and growth there, and we work with the Papua New Guinea government to try and foster good governance and try and improve how the country runs at the same time as working on issues like education to try and promote economic growth. I've never been to Papua New Guinea. It's the only APEC member I've never been to, but it has some unique challenges. But the delegates to participate in the APEC discussions say that they find it very, very useful.
Mm-hmm.
One issue that we've taken up in APEC this year is combating illegal logging, both for environmental reasons, but also to try and fight corruption and bad governance, because the legal loggers tend to try and protect their operations by through bribes and the like. And Papua New Guinea and as well as Indonesia are very enthusiastic supporters of this work. They find it very, very valuable.
And finally, Ambassador Kurt Tong, you've worked for the U.S. State Department for many years now. You became the U.S. senior official for APEC during the Obama as part of the Obama administration. How has U.S. administration policy towards the Pacific Rim changed from the second Bush administration to the Obama administration?
You know, there's really a lot of continuity. Many of the issues that we're working on, both in the sense of problems but also opportunities, are consistent from year to year. And so really the fundamentals of our approach to the Asia-Pacific, our emphasis on the alliances with Japan and Republic of Korea and Australia and the Philippines and Thailand, and our work with China, pragmatic work to cooperate constructively with China and try and accomplish change over the long term, is pretty consistent from administration to administration. And I think the reason for that is that there's a fairly strong consensus view of people in the United States about the importance of the Asia-Pacific and the fundamentals of our approach, that we should be trying to link our economy more closely to that dynamic region, but at the same time trying to preserve peace and security in that region through our forward diplomatic and military presence.
Ambassador Kurt Tong, U.S. Senior Official for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC, at the U.S. Department of State. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how a formerly homeless woman in Sacramento used soccer to help get her life back on track. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On Monday, an important vote on the California budget is coming up soon. You'll hear where things stand, including the likelihood of a state budget being passed in time for the next fiscal year. That's Insight on Monday. A few years ago, Lisa Reitzman was a semi-professional soccer player. She played for the Elk Grove Pride and had also played soccer at Sacramento State. Then her life took a sharp turn for the worse, including drugs, jail, and homelessness. But Lisa Reitzman is back on track. She's no longer homeless, and soccer is still an important part of her life. She's coach of the street soccer team, the Sacramento Mohawks, and she's also represented the U.S. In the Homeless World Cup. She's in our studio right now with the team captain of the Sacramento Mohawks, who is Lisa Stanley. So Lisa Stanley, team captain, Lisa Reitzman, coach, welcome to Insight.
Right, thank you.
Thank you.
So street soccer, what does that involve, Lisa Reitzman?
A soccer ball and a street. At the basics form of it. What we have now is the Street Soccer USA, and the tournament, it's the size of a basketball court with about 4-foot-high walls surrounding it and 4 players on each side, and that's the game.
And why play it on a street as opposed to on a field, which is the norm for soccer?
Well, don't leave out the word homeless, street soccer.
Okay.
Which is why. That's why, because in every other country, it actually is the poor man's sport, really. In other countries, that is all they have. They'll play soccer with anything. So for homeless, street soccer, people who maybe don't have the resources to play organized or formal way of the game, that's all we need is a ball and space.
Yeah. Lisa Stanley, how long have you been playing street soccer?
Well, when Lisa Reitzman came back from Rio last year, she came back and she said that we're gonna start a women's team. And so I've been practicing with her ever since.
Yeah. Now, Lisa Reitzman, your story, there's a sort of rise and fall and rise when it comes to soccer for you, because, as I said, when I was introducing you, you played semi-pro soccer for the Elk Grove Pride. What happened?
It's interesting because soccer, when I look back now, I realize that was the one place that I had freedom. That was where I felt free and safe despite anything else going on in my life. And that's what made me good. I loved being out there because I needed it. That was my freedom. So as you get better at things like that, as you go to college and play on sports, there's expectations that you'll perform any professional level.
Yeah.
You don't just show up anymore. I mean, you can, but they invest in you. And in semi-pro, it kind of got caught between a place where I've invested the majority of my life in something I love. I wanted to continue to go professional and go there with it, but it just wasn't working out that way. When I got into college, I had experimented with alcohol and drugs. I used them in high school. When I got to college, it was like, yes, because all of a sudden I was doing really good in soccer, and it was really fun, and it was really fun to glamorize it, and just that was me. I got a big ego, and it was just, you know, it was fun. It got out of control. And so
the drug use got out of control.
Yeah, and the partying.
College.
Yeah, and the partying. The structure kept me to where I was still doing okay. But after college, when I lost that structure, alcohol and drugs definitely, I also found freedom in those. And it's much easier to feel that freedom drinking a beer than it is like running for 3 hours. It's not a better decision, but...
Yeah. And what was the low point?
It was soccer. I just wasn't happy anymore, and I was looking through it in semi-pro soccer and playing, and I just wasn't happy anymore. I didn't know how to do it, and I had hit a point where I was definitely addicted to drugs, and I didn't really know what to do or how to do it. The low point was getting arrested multiple times, but the very last time, you push everybody. I had lost everybody in my life. I had lost everything. I didn't have anything anymore.
So were you in jail and you realized this is the turning point?
Yeah. 18 months ago was the last time I was in jail. And I didn't start off with hard drugs. Like I started off partying, drinking beers. And then this last time in jail, I was a full-on meth addict. You know, they don't have mirrors in jail, but like I got arrested and this was a low point. This is not where I came from. This isn't how I grew up. They take a picture when they book you in jail. And they put it on a bracelet, you know, and I looked at it and it was just, that was like, that is the face of what you see. This is what happens when you use drugs. And you're like, oh my God, like, how did this happen?
Yeah. And so you got out of jail and you got back into soccer. How did that come about?
Yeah. Actually, I didn't expect to ever play again. I didn't want to, but I went, you know, in jail, you're like, obviously I had accepted the fact I am a drug addict and need help. And I needed to get sober and learn how to do that. I went to a 90-day rehab program. And through that program, they referred me to like a transitional living with Volunteers of America, which is just a way to kind of get acclimated to sober life and learning responsibilities and life skills again. And so that's where my case manager, oh my God, Chris Mann, there to get a job and pull my life together and be like, soccer is done. I need to get serious about life. No more games. And so I was there to just be focused. And first thing he says is like, hey, I heard you play soccer.
Uh-huh.
Like, no.
You live at, do you still live at the Mather Community Campus run by Volunteer of America?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he asked if I wanted to play. And I said, no, I'm done with soccer. Soccer is why I'm here. Right. And then I went out and played one day and like, that was all it took.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Lisa Stanley? What's your story? What brought you to the Sacramento Mohawks?
I have a similar story. I found myself in jail again, and apart from my kids, alcohol and drugs ruled my life. And when I got out of jail, I checked myself into Volunteers of America, and I'm still there at the transitional employment program, and I had missed out a lot. My kids played soccer for years, and I was rarely present for any of their games. And once I got sober and seeing that they're, you know, really good on the field, I found that same love for soccer. And when Lisa Reitzman came back and said there was going to be a women's team, I was very excited.
Had you played soccer when you were younger?
Never any sports.
Well, I guess Lisa Reitzman, it turned out pretty well because she's the captain of the team.
Stanley?
Yes, Lisa Stanley.
Yeah, well, it's the thing with the street soccer is most people have never played before. That's why it's so fun, like, because you really, you know, it's they can learn it. I can teach. I knew I could teach that. I have the experience to coach, but like I just needed someone to show up and want to play. And so yeah, she fell in like you got to, you know, it's easy to get like hooked on.
And it's also brought a bond back with my children that I've been apart for so long.
Yeah.
Yes.
So they can root for the mom now.
And play too. They're at every practice with us and they're a part of us. They're part of the team.
Her kids have been like, they were so crucial in the beginning because we didn't have the enthusiasm because nobody really knew how to play. And her kids did. And we needed, they were like the other half of our team.
Yes.
Mm. And one game, her and her daughters, she gave her daughter an assist, the score goal, playing together. You know, and that's powerful.
So, Lisa Reitzman, tell us about the Homeless World Cup and your involvement in it.
Well, I was chosen to go last year to Brazil.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was Rio de Janeiro. And it wasn't the World Cup I thought I'd go to one day. It actually meant more because this was just about the love of the game, and it was really me making changes in my life and willing to do something different than what I, you know, had expected. But it was like 54 countries all on the beaches of Rio de Janeiro, the Copacabana beach. They set the fields up, and then you have the Christ the Redeemer, you know, in sight, which is also a whole nother spiritual experience if you want to go there with it. But there's just like a week-long tournament, countries, 54 different countries, all playing to overcome homelessness.
And it happens, unlike the real World Cup, it which happens every 4 years, this is an annual event, right?
Yeah.
So what about this year?
Paris,
yeah. It's in Paris. I want to say it's going to be the end of September, but it's huge. I went to this thing and just realized on a world level that there is like much hope to be had.
Have you been chosen for this year's World Cup?
Well, they don't do that yet. I couldn't play in it because this is what's really cool too about the whole concept of it is you aren't eligible to play once you've been to the Homeless World Cup because they want it to be a temporary problem. They don't want you to continue to be eligible because that would mean you're always homeless.
So, yeah, I see.
So the idea is that once you go to these events, it's the same as DC, Washington DC, the U.S. National Cup. It impacts you in a way to where you can get out of homelessness and give you skills to use. So the Homeless World Cup is the same thing. I would love to go back as a coach, but this year we're going to get to D.C. and hopefully we'll have a couple players selected to go.
Well, what about you, Lisa Stanley? Are you hoping to be chosen?
I am hoping to be chosen.
Yeah?
Yes.
Are you doing anything special to try and improve your chances?
I'm getting ready. Passport-wise.
Well, they get all legal, I know.
Well, Lisa Reitzman, what do you think Lisa Stanley's chances are?
They're good. It's not based on skill. It's really character. And we are becoming ambassadors of it. As much as I didn't want to say that about myself, like the women that we're bringing and want to show is this is who is overcoming like life's challenges. And this is why you need to see her. This is why she needs to be there. Not necessarily because of the level of play, which she has improved tremendously, but it's the same thing. You get better when you continue to try at things.
And where can people see the Sacramento Mohawks play?
Ooh, we practice Saturday mornings at the Mather Community Campus, the VOA Employment Program. And we just had a play day. We'll probably have one in the end of July where we'll invite the entire community to come out and just play games.
Sounds fun.
Yeah.
Well, thanks to you both and best wishes to you both. Lisa Reitzman is coach of the Sacramento Mohawks street soccer team, and Lisa Stanley is the captain of the team. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that's Insight. When we come back, the seventh Python, we'll talk with musical humorist Neil Innes. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. This weekend in Sacramento, there's a film called The Seventh Python, and it refers to Monty Python, not snakes. If you are familiar with Monty Python, six people probably come to mind, the six people that you saw on the TV show and in the films. But a regular collaborator with Monty Python was the musician and humorist Neil Innes, and he's sometimes called the Seventh Python, and a film about Neil Innes' life and work by that name is being shown on Sunday evening at Sacramento's Guild Theatre. We hope to speak with Neil Innes a little later, but for now, we're joined by the film's producer, Brett Hudson, and the director, Bert Kearns. Brett, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Brett, tell us, what's the story behind making the film, The Seventh Python? What gave you both the idea for it? Brett Hudson, can you hear me?
Hey, this is Bert Kearns. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Okay, go ahead. Just answer the question.
Everybody's disappeared. Neil Innes is in our consideration.
Hello.
We're having some microphone problems here. So, who is that? Is that Brett Hudson?
This is Brett Hudson. Yes.
Okay. So, Brett, I'll just go back to you. What's the story behind making the film The Seventh Python?
Well, my partner Bert Kearns, who also directed it, had interviewed Neil as Ron about the death of John Lennon on a documentary he was doing. And when Bert came back, he said, "You know, we should do this. We should do a movie." A documentary about Neil Innes. It's a very interesting story. And I said, that's a great idea. So I went out and raised the money, and we contacted Neil, and he came out to Los Angeles. He was doing two concerts. So it's a musical documentary because we shot his concerts. And then we just told kind of, not necessarily the background story of Neil, but it's interesting because when you see this documentary, you realize that if Neil Innes wasn't around, pop culture would be different. He's a phenomenal It's true. He's a phenomenal songwriter, very clever, and he worked with the Pythons back almost before they were the Pythons, which is kind of interesting. They've known each other for many, many years, and it's a very interesting story because it deals with everything in pop culture that we know about the Pythons. I mean, you know, Sir Robin and all those great little tunes that were in their movies. Neil had a hand in all of that.
Yeah.
He wrote all the music for the Ruddles, and he was Ron Nasty in the Ruddles when that was out. And he's just it's a very quirky but inspiring documentary.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of it, and if I do say so myself. Bert did a phenomenal job directing it.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the Ruttles there. The Ruttles is a parody group that Neil Innes formed with Eric Idle, who was part of Monty Python. And here's one of the songs that Neil wrote for the Ruttles. It's a Beatles parody, and it's called I Must Be in Love.
I feel good, I feel bad, I feel happy, I feel sad.
Bert Kearns, when you listen to the Ruttles' music, it basically goes through the whole Beatles' career with these spot-on parodies of music from every part of their career, and it really comes down to Neil Innes. And it's kind of interesting to note that the Beatles are old friends of Neil Innes. Do we know what they made of the Ruttles?
I don't know if Bert is there, but
okay.
I can answer that.
Okay, go ahead, Brett.
Well, Neil and his band, the Bonzo Doodog Band, they were actually in Magical Mystery Tour, and a big hit record that Neil and his band had in England called that actually Paul McCartney produced, called Urban Spaceman. That Paul McCartney produced, but on the record it doesn't say Paul McCartney. It's a fictitious name, and I won't give it away because it's in the documentary. But he actually, spent a lot of time with. He was very good friends with George Harrison, and there's a song in the documentary that brought me to tears when I heard it, that he wrote for George and his passing. And it's just, it's a beautiful, beautiful song. But, you know, Neil was, he was around in that time in England when everything was sparking. You know, it was the onslaught of the British invasion, and Neil was part of that in a very unique way. I mean, yes. The Bonzo Doodah band was phenomenal. They had a kids show that was watched by more adults. It was on like 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Thursday or a Saturday, and the audience was basically much older than a kid show because they were so interesting and very funny.
Mm-hmm.
But the music, I'll tell you, Neil is an incredible songwriter. And even though some of his parodies, I mean, my favorite song that he did with the Ruttles was Ouch, which is the parody of Help. And it's just, he's just very clever. He's a very bright man. And I had it was such a pleasure to work with him.
Yes.
I cannot say enough about him. And my partner, Bert Kearns, when you see it, he directed it. He did an incredible job of piecing this, putting it together so you can get such great insight, not yeah. only to Neil, but also the Pythons as well. John Cleese, every time I see it still, and I've seen it a billion times, he still makes me laugh.
Yeah. My guest is Brett Hudson. He's producer of the film The Seventh Python, about the musician and humorist Neil Innes. And earlier, Brett mentioned the song I'm the Urban Spaceman that Neil Innes wrote for the 60s group, the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. This is the song that was actually produced anonymously by Paul McCartney. I'm the Urban Spaceman.
I'm the Urban Spaceman, baby. I've got speed. I've got everything I need.
I've been told that Neil Innes, who was going to join us, and also Bert Kearns, who's the director of the Seventh Python, that we can't reach them. They're actually in the desert, and we've lost their cell phone signal. But just very briefly, Brett Hudson, what does Neil Innes think about being referred to as the Seventh Python?
You know, Neil, and God love him for this, you know, Neil is, he really shies away from celebrity. I mean, he truly does. He's very humble about it, but John Cleese, Eric Idle, Michael Palin, Terry Jones, all of them said point blank, yeah, he would have, if there were seven of us, it would have been Neil. Neil's very humbled by it, I believe. But, you know, it's a hell of a compliment to get, because the Pythons were fantastic. Still to this day, I don't think anybody has matched that humor that they did back then. I'm still a big fan, always have been, always will be. But Neil is... Neil's very shy about it. I guess that's the best word I can think of. But
yeah.
That's a hell of a compliment to be put in that group with those those gentlemen. I understand why he is humble. I mean, I was humble just interviewing them.
Yeah. Brett Hudson, producer of the film The Seventh Python, about the musician and humorist Neil Innes. It's being shown this Sunday evening at Sacramento's Guild Theatre. It's part of the Movies on a Big Screen series, and it starts at 7:30. Brett Hudson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. And everybody come out with your question and answer afterwards, and I'll answer all the questions I can, and the ones I can't, Bert will answer.
How's okay.
That? Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. And that's Insight for today and for this week. Our theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers, Lynn Weaver, Sosin Marar, and Liz Cazares. The technical director, Mark Jones. The senior producer, Jen Picard. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We'll see you next week. At Insight, we have one goal.
Wanting to get more insight.
To get the answers you want to hear.
That's a very good question.
Good to be here in the Culture Bunker.
It's interesting that you asked.
I'm glad you asked.
From interesting people of every stripe.
You really have delved into my deepest, darkest secrets.
What do you got to bring that up for?
It's kind of give you more of a deep, more serious insight.
Well, this could work.
I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Monday morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.